phone, tell me what time it is. Oh, y'all look so good out there, and I see a lot of y'all stuck around for Sunday morning. Lots of people don't do that. I'm Joy, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a grateful alcoholic, and I say that because thank God I found out what was wrong with me. I just thought I was crazy, and so did everybody else that knew me. But I do have an excuse now because I'm an alcoholic. That's no excuse, but it has given me hope and given me a program of recovery so that I can change. It wasn't something that I set out to do as a young child. I didn't say I wanted to grow up and be an alcoholic. In fact, I didn't know much about alcoholism. My sobriety date is May the 17th, 1987. Got sober in Georgia. People asked me when I got here where I'm from, and I said, pick a place, because I didn't live a lot of places. I don't necessarily think they were geographical cures until I got older, but I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember what happened in 1947 in Roswell, New Mexico. I had a feeling always that that's when the day that I was born in 1947, and I felt like they just flew over Texas and dropped me off. And all my life I felt like an alien. I did not fit in anywhere. I was born in Texas and I was adopted when I was very, very young, just a baby, 6 months old. I was brought home to a Jewish family in a little small town in Arkansas, which is in the Mississippi Delta. And that's where I lived until I was about 12 or 13. My family didn't drink. They had alcohol in the house, but they served it on special occasions, or if somebody wanted a drink, they had it. But it wasn't something that they did. My grandmother lived with us, and she constantly would tell me that I was lazy, and I was stupid, and I would never amount to anything. And you get told that enough, and you really start to believe it. So I had inferiority complex right from the beginning, right from the get-go. She lived with us until she died, and then my father died about, I think, when I was like 11, and my parents, my mother and my grandmother, moved me to, because she wanted to be next to her brother. Her brother lived in New Orleans, Louisiana. So they moved me to New Orleans at that age, and boy, I tell you what, that is a wide open town. My drinking began to get really bad there. I can remember my very first drink, though. I was raised in a Jewish home, and we had Seder, and that was and we had the Jewish New Year, and we had all of those celebrations were celebrated with wine at the table and the dinners, and the kids were given grape juice. And I think I was about 11 years old, and I wondered why we couldn't have, why can't I have wine? Well, what is that, you know? So at the end of the dinner, there was a large group of about 40 people, all families. At the end of the dinner, I proceeded to go around and drink what was left of all the wine from the adults. I will never forget that feeling as long as I live. For the very first time in my life, I felt really good. Very special, very normal. I mean, it hit me and I could feel that warm going down and out into my fingers, and it was just like, man, this is awesome. Couldn't wait to do it again. But, you know, we didn't do that much. So I didn't think about it too much anymore until I got to New Orleans. And drinking was a way of life there. All the people that I went to high school with drank. All their parents provided alcohol for us at home. Their theory was, we'd rather have you drinking at home than out drinking in public. Well, we did both. We drank in public. High school, our favorite hangouts in high school were bars. So I didn't really think about anything about being an alcoholic. My parents, my mother said, oh, they're having an AA convention here in New Orleans. Ha, ha, ha. What a crazy place to have an AA convention, you know. I didn't think about that. It was just like, well, there's a lot of places for them to drink, which is not the purpose at all. But so I started growing up there, and I loved it, absolutely loved it. For the first time in my life, you know, I went to a high school, and I was popular. You know, I always wanted everyone to like me, and I felt so different growing up. And a small town being Jewish was not necessarily a good thing. We were kind of looked down upon, and because everybody thought we were different. My parents were very hardworking people. They had a store, and I got left at home alone. But well, I grew up, and they made money, and I was denied nothing. I had a wonderful childhood. I didn't know that till I got sober, though. I didn't like them very much. My mother and I always had problems. We had conflicts, and because I was a very rebellious teenager, and I know, God bless her, that she thought some days, what the heck have we gotten ourselves into? I didn't listen to anything they said. In fact, I was always bucking the system. I was always doing the opposite thing. If they tell me to do something, I would do the opposite all my life. And I guess that's one of my alcoholic traits. I think that I was an alcoholic right from the get-go. I look back on my behavior, and there was just no doubt about it. I wasn't drinking yet, but I just hadn't picked it up yet. I had all the isms that there were to have. And just didn't know. I mean, when we moved to New Orleans, there were some wonderful restaurants there, and my family had wonderful parties and weddings, and I never made it to dinner because somebody always had to take me home because I had too much to drink. I'd pass out, or I'd get sick, or I'd be on the floor in the bathroom, and where's Joy? And I was 16 years old when this was going on. And I loved to drink, try to drink people under the table. I think Mary, we heard that speaker last night. She said she was a hard drinker and she could outdrink anybody. Well, that was what I wanted to do. I was out to outdrink anybody. And I did not like the taste of alcohol. I started out drinking scotch. God, that stuff is horrible. But let me tell you, I did not drink for the taste. I drank for the effect. And when I got to college, when I got into my college age, I drank a lot of jungle juice because that's what they were doing up at LSU and Tulane and all those places that I grew up around. I didn't really go to college. I went to art school for 2 years, and I was scared. I was shy. I was afraid of everything, and I was miserable. I felt like I was an adolescent all my life. Adolescence is a disease too, you know. I never grew out of it. but I'll tell you what, the drinking made everything better for me. Drinking made my life manageable. And I really, like I said, did not know I was an alcoholic until I got sober at 40. And that was a rude awakening. I was 40 years old. I was divorced with 3 children, a single parent, and I had to finally grow up. And Bill mentioned that, you know, we don't grow up mentally. We don't mature because when we start drinking alcoholically, that's the brain we have for the rest of the time. And when I started drinking alcoholically about 15, I came into the program 40 years old with a 15-year-old brain. And that's how I thought. That's how I dressed. I walked into the rooms of AA, and I was kind of cute back then. And and I'd like to flaunt it, because I wanted to be the center of attention. In fact, one of my sponsors said, well, I was complaining about how all the guys were kind of attracted to me, and I got really tired of it. wink, wink. And she said, well, maybe if you didn't dress the way you do, they would quit looking at you. It's like, what a concept. So you see, I've gotten a little more conservative over the years, but I tell you what the final blow was. I had three husbands. I was married three times. Number one was high school sweetheart. He was the football guy and I was the cheerleader, and it was kind of like a storybook thing. We got married at 20, and that didn't work out. He didn't like to drink a lot, but he sure did like women, other women. And that kind of broke up the deal. We had one child, and we got a divorce. That was kind of devastating. Number two, I met at work. I got a job at medical electronics company in New Orleans, and met my second husband. We had drinking in common. It was a wonderful relationship in the beginning, and that went sour really quickly. I think that lasted for about maybe 12 years. I married him twice. Don't we hear of that a lot in the program? So we had two children, and his drinking was so bad that I was concentrating more on the anger and the resentment I felt against him and his drinking. I didn't look at mine. I hated his drinking. I mean, I would be stuck home with the kids and he would be out partying all the time. I got huge resentment because I wanted to go too, and I couldn't because we had kids. Somebody had to stay home with them. So my mother moved in with us, and thank God for her. She moved in with us because she took care of the kids while we got to go out and party. And when that relationship split up, it was, I started working for the company and he was working for the company. And they said, when you get married, you have to go because we don't allow married couples working in the same company. I knew why that was, because I was in that company. And at that time, there was a lot of drinking going on. I mean, that was a way of company initiation. Everybody drank and you had to drink. He was in charge of the hospitality suite at all the conventions and the meetings and everything that the company would have. And of course, that was wonderful. I mean, we got drunk a lot, you know, after work we'd have, I would go to have a drink after work, and I never went home. But I didn't look at that as anything unusual. Till I got sober. And I just didn't see, we lived in East Cobb, and I just didn't see how a nice Jewish girl like me, an East Cobb housewife, could be an alcoholic, because my picture was that under the bridge with the paper bag and, you know, homeless person, bag lady type person, and that just wasn't me. So it took me a long time to get it. I started out in Al-Anon. I had to put three of my girls, we had three girls, I had to put three of my girls into treatment at one time or another. My middle child was in probably five different treatment centers. She started out at 13 using drugs. And my oldest daughter had a cocaine problem at 16. So I was going to the family meetings and to Al-Anon and Nar-Anon and all the Anons there were, and trying to learn as much as I could. But, you know, I would have drinks before I would go to those things, and they suggested that maybe I not drink before, but wait till afterwards to go have a drink. We had family sessions, and I mean, I was a part of all of that, but I still did not get that I had a problem. It just didn't dawn on me. And when I was young and growing up, spirituality was something that was just I mean, I grew up in the Jewish religion and I was confirmed and I went to temple every Friday night and I hated it. But I also went to the Baptist church with my friends and heard the hellfire and brimstone. And I went to the Catholic. I went to Catholic school too. Parents sent me to Catholic school, and I heard that I would go to hell, you know, if I didn't do so many novenas and do my confession. I was really confused and didn't like organized religion much. So I came into the program with that in the back of my head. I didn't want to be involved in organized religion in any way, shape, or form. I had thought that I had been so bad that God would not have anything to do with me. I thought if I even said the word God, that this big lightning bolt was going to come out and strike me dead. So me and God didn't have much of a relationship. I thought the only reason we went to church or to temple was to show everybody how good we looked and how we dressed, and it was very hypocritical to me. So I kind of left that at an early age. And then I started going downhill really bad after the number two divorce. I got in a relationship, I don't know about you, any of you other women, but I never had an ending to one without another one coming in the back door. I went from my family to the first husband, to the second husband, to the next boyfriend. That's the way I lived. I didn't feel like I could live alone. I always felt like I had to have a man in my life. And when I got sober, I went into the first meeting I went to. For me, I had to take my kids to meetings when they got out of treatment, and so I knew where they were. The first meeting that I went, for me, there was this really cute guy up there handing out chips. I thought, well, I think I'll get a chip. I knew I'd get a hug, you know, so that was me. At the end, I was in a relationship with a guy who was a drug addict, and he was a pothead. He could not live without smoking pot from the day time he woke up till the time he went to sleep. And I wasn't much of a dry goods person. I tried a few of those things, you know, because I grew up in the 60s, and drugs really kind of got popular, but they were good drugs. They were pure drugs back then, not so pure anymore. But I tried a couple of things, and I just didn't like the way they made me feel. It was just like, I don't want any more of this. Give me a drink. I had a drink of alcohol, and I felt in control. I loved it. It didn't make me feel stupid. I felt smart and popular, and I was really good looking. I could dance. I could talk to everybody because I was basically shy and a kind of an introvert. And I was pretty much a loner when I was growing up. I'd sit in my closet and play with my dolls by myself. The first time I thought about getting sober was I just couldn't stand what was going on around me. I would go to his house. He lived in a place where the power had been turned off, and there were like two or three other guys living there, some with their girlfriends, and there was drugs going on over there, drinking going on over there, and I'd stay there overnight, and like I said, my mother was home with my girls, and I'd stay there overnight, and I would wake up early in the morning and pick up Dunkin' Donuts on my way home and come in and wake up the kids and say, I got up and I went and got you donuts. And they thought I was there all night. Probably not, but I thought it was a good idea. So I was just fooling everybody. I was lying to them. I never called my mother to tell her that I wasn't coming home. I was just totally irresponsible. I took a drink and the drink took me. I didn't think about anything else but where I was going to get the next drink. And at the time, when I was younger, I didn't spend a lot of money on alcohol because I had men buying me drinks all the time. Some people said they went broke, but I used to find money on the dance floor, you know, that kind of stuff. But men used to buy most of my drinks. I don't think I could be drunk today. Alcohol is just way too expensive now. There's a lot of things have changed since I was drinking. Man, I tell you what. But One morning I woke up in that house and I went out to the living room, and I mean, it was a mess all the time. It was just a mess. There was a pond in front of the house, and my boyfriend had to go out and get a bucket of water so he could flush the toilet, because that had been turned off too. And he had a good business going, was because I helped him in his business. And I'm just, you know, an alcoholic woman. I think, well, if I'm good enough and if I do enough great things, he will change. That's not true, y'all. They don't change until they're ready to change, and there's nothing that I can do to make that happen. But I tried that, and but I mean, everything was a real mess. And I woke up, and I'm sitting there in the living room, and there's nothing but empty beer cans and wine bottles all over the place, and joints that hadn't been smoked. And I got looking around, and I thought, what's a nice Jewish girl like you doing in a place like this? That's where alcohol took me. Staying in a place with a bunch of drug addicts and drunks, and there I sit. And I wasn't real proud of that. And I got to thinking about it. And because my kids had been in treatment, I knew where to go. I mean, I knew what alcoholism was all about. But I will say this, it was real hard for me to qualify because I'd never been in jail. I'd never gotten a DUI. You know, back then when I was drinking, if the cops thought you were drunk, they'd pull you over maybe, and they'd ask you if you were okay to drive home, and they'd follow you home, or they'd take you home. They didn't give you DUIs. You didn't get arrested. And you know, you bat your eyes a couple of times, and they forget all about writing you a ticket. But all of those things, and my mother was a very good enabler. She gave me everything I ever wanted, and just enabled me to the max, and because she loved me. And she wanted me to have everything growing up. And that was a good thing now, I see. But I hated them for that. I never had to work. I was always given everything, and when I grew up, I didn't have the skills to be an adult. I didn't realize that, though, until I got sober. So I had been going to this this spiritual at a place called Ridgeview, which is in Smyrna, Georgia, and it was connected with a treatment center where one of my kids went, and I got real attached to this this priest who had left the priesthood there that was their spiritual leader there at that treatment center. His name was Father Noel. And I used to go to his spirit. Anybody could go to it on Sunday mornings. And I remember going every Sunday morning, and he opened my eyes a little bit about God, because he used to say, if you think that there is no God, just look around you. Look outside. Look at the sky. Look at nature. And I used to love nature because I was a real outdoor girl. And you didn't do that. Who did that? And it's like, well, you know, that makes a little sense. So I remember the last morning of my last drink, I was in a lot of pain emotionally. That's what drove me into AA, was the pain, the emotional pain. And I just couldn't take it anymore. And I was sitting in the back of the room, and there must have been about 70 people in that room. And the whole time he was talking, he was looking at me, right? Looking at me the whole time. And I don't know what it was, but there was something going on in my head that day that said, you need to go to a meeting. And I knew where they were. And there was one that was not far from Ridgeview. So that day I hopped in my car and I went to the Rebos Club in Smyrna. And I didn't want to go in because I was scared, full of fear, guilt, shame, and remorse, and all that stuff that we feel all of our lives. And there was this big old push, it felt like. And I opened the door and I got out of the car, and I felt like this hand was just pushing me. And I walked up to the door and I opened it. I don't know what That was a God thing. That was a true God thing. And I went through the doors, and I went and sat down. And like I said, the cute guy was up there at the end handing out the chips, so that was an incentive. I wasn't well yet. So I went up there and picked out a white chip. In Georgia, a white chip is our international sign of surrender. And I just felt like for the first time I felt safe, and I felt like I belonged somewhere. I still wasn't getting the fact, really, that I was an alcoholic, because all those things hadn't happened to me yet. And I say yet because they're still out there. Wait, those yets are still out there. So I sat in meetings, and I sat in the back of the room, and all I did was cry. I cried for a year. I just cried and I cried and I cried. And there was an older man that I used to sit next to all the time. He had like he had 38 years to my couple of months, and he'd pat me on the back and he'd say, "It's gonna be all right. Just keep coming. It's gonna be all right." Well, when I walked through the door, none of the women wanted to have anything to do with me. I can't imagine why. And a lot of the men wanted to have a lot to do with me, so I got a lot of guys coming up going, "I'm gonna be your sponsor." Somehow, I don't know what it was, intuitive thought or whatever, I knew that was not a good idea. So, and I asked several women to be my sponsor, and everybody said no. So I flailed around for a little while, for almost a year without a sponsor. And I stayed sober completely on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for y'all. Thank God, because that is God's grace right there. That's God's grace. For me sitting in the rooms, I'm saying I'm an alcoholic, but not really, really, truly believing I'm an alcoholic. But I'm listening. I'm listening to the women, I'm listening to the men, I'm listening to the stories. I got hooked up with a bunch of biker guys, which I just loved them, because we would go out after a meeting and they would talk about their experiences and how they got sober and how they came to believe in a power greater than themselves. And I'd listen to that, and I would just be amazed. It's like their lives were so much harder than mine, and they could get this. Well, maybe I could too if I just stuck around long enough. And I don't know why, but I didn't go to treatment. I came in through the doors on my own, and I heard a lot of treatment jargon, like go to 90 meetings in 90 days, get yourself a sponsor, work the steps. I heard all of that. But the only thing I was really doing was going to 90 meetings in 90 days. Sometimes I went to 2 meetings a day. And my car just automatically took me there. I wasn't working at the time, which was good, so I could do that. God was great in that area. He knew just what I needed. So I stuck in with the meetings, and after about 2.5 years, I was having a great time with the fellowship. It was awesome, you know, it was lots of fun, and I didn't know how to have fun without drinking. And I found out that I could have fun, and I heard the laughter coming from the room. I wasn't laughing very much about anything when I got to the rooms, but I heard that, and that was attractive to me. People told me things like, "Stick with the winners," and you know, I didn't know who they were, but I kind of stuck there. And I found them, though. I found out who they were, and I finally got to the point in the fellowship. People tried to give me big books and I'd lose them, or like Red was saying the other night, you know, use them for coasters, you know, I'd throw them in the trunk of my car and then I couldn't find them. Couldn't see what anything. My first resentment was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous being so much about men. It's like, you know, what could possibly be in there for me as a woman? It's all about some old fart in the 1930s that got sober, you know. I didn't think I needed to read that. And then my second resentment, and I didn't know these were resentments at the time because I wasn't reading the book. Second resentment was people who got to go to treatment. I didn't like y'all very much because I'm thinking, you know, these people are going into a treatment center. They're being taken care of. They're being cooked for. They don't have to deal with any of the problems with children or life or anything for, at that time, usually 28 days. And I thought, damn. that must have been nice. And I talked to a friend about that, an older gentleman. I always gravitated towards the older men in the program for help because I never had a really good father figure. And I was in therapy too, and my therapist said, select a couple of the older men in the rooms and kind of talk to them, because it kind of replaced the father thing that I never had when I was growing up. My father, my adoptive father and I weren't very close, and he died when I was very young. So I gravitated towards them, and you know, they were just so loving and so nice, and I knew they weren't out to get anything more than that. So they would say and be very kind things like, you know, you shouldn't have a resentment. You'd probably just need a vacation. You just need to go on a vacation. And I was working really, really hard then. And so I did, and that was great. But they took me under their wing, and they gave me a lot of fatherly advice, which I never had, and I really needed that. Because I was looking for attention from men all my life, because I felt like that got me where I needed to go. And I tell my daughters, I used to tell my daughters all the time, especially my middle one, you know, she's a gorgeous, gorgeous woman, my middle child. All my girls are pretty, but this one was especially beautiful. And I said, you know, those looks are going to get you in the door, but they're not going to keep you there very long if you don't do the work you're supposed to do. And the looks got me in a lot of doors, opened a lot of doors for me, but didn't keep me there. Got me a couple of husbands. And my picker was broken, so that wasn't all that great. I had a bad picker and a short memory. So when I walked through the doors, and you know, and I felt really good, and I got sober in about 2 years in the program, I started getting really miserable. Really miserable. And I wanted to die. I knew that drinking wasn't an option. I already knew that. I think I'd taken that first step pretty much. It just wasn't an option. So I figured, you know, killing myself is an option. So I called up Bob C. I guess this was about 2 o'clock in the morning, God bless him, and he was in his 80s. I'm sure I woke him up from really good sleep. And I said, I want to kill myself, and I don't know what to do. And he said, you don't want to kill yourself. You just need to get sober. And at the time, you know, I wasn't drinking. Somebody talked about that last night. Sobriety, what sobriety means to me. It's more than just not drinking. It's my thinking that's the problem. And I didn't know this. So I went back to some meetings at the clubhouse, and people could see that I was in pain. And again, and they suggested things to me like, why don't you get a sponsor and read the book and work the steps and go to some big book studies and some step studies and get away from this clubhouse for a while? And I thought, okay. I was willing to do, at that point, I became willing to do anything to feel better. So I found this big book study called The Goose Hung High. And if you all read the big book, you know what The Goose Hung High is. It's in there. And it was led by a guy called Railroad Bob. He was from Tracy City, Tennessee, right up the road here. And I did have a female sponsor, but she didn't really take me through the book much. And I knew that I needed that. But I went to this Thursday night meeting, and this guy, Railroad Bob, I don't know, I think it was because I was finally ready to hear what I was supposed to hear. And when he read the book and he explained it to, we studied the book paragraph by paragraph. And sometimes it would take us a year to get through the first 164 pages. And he explained that book to me in a way that I could understand for the very first time. Now, I don't know whether that was because I wasn't ready to hear it or because he just had something that opened a door in my mind. And man, I hung on every word. It was like I had this thirst for the first time to learn about what this program was all about, how it applied to me and how I could apply it in my life. I was interested in the history and in the steps and in the big book. And It was a spiritual awakening. You know, I had these little spiritual awakening moments all throughout my sobriety, and it was like a spiritual awakening. Well, Bob at the time was good friends with Charlie Parmalee. They had both had the same last name. They were cousins. And they had a Joe and Charlie Big Book study in Atlanta. I don't remember what year it was. I'm not good at numbers, but our memory. But I went to it, and if you heard Red's story on Friday night, he talked about this guy named Frank. Well, Frank was a friend of mine. I didn't know Red at the time. Frank was a friend of mine, and he went to that meeting. And we all went to that Big Book study. We were all the brats. They used to call us the brat pack because we were young in sobriety, and we all hung out together. And we went to this Joe and Charlie meeting, and of course I was sitting in a row with all the other brats. And we had a room, I don't know about you guys on conventions, but we had a room there, and we must have had six people in our room. People were sleeping on the floor, you know, guys and girls. We just all piled in because none of us had any money, and we just shared everything. And so we were all piled in, and they were sitting in one row. And when I heard Charlie, and this was the original Joe, Joe McQueenie, oh my God, just something emanated from those two men. They were sitting up at the table, and they had all this information, and it was just like a projection machine of spirituality and love. I mean, it was just, it's like a warm fuzzy. Like you talked about that warm fuzzy, those guys sitting up there. And this light bulb, they were talking about the book, and I had my book was up. I was underlining, I was writing, I was highlighting. I was doing all this stuff. For the very first time in my life, things started to make sense. It was like this light bulb went on in my head. It's like, oh, that's what they're talking about. You know how that, I could have had a V8, you know? I wish I'd have gotten it the first year, but I didn't. I got it when I was ready to get it. But that was one of the most wonderful spiritual experiences I've ever had, was meeting those two guys. And, you know, as time went on and the relationships developed, Bob became my sponsor, my Big Book sponsor. And Charlie was kind of like my grand sponsor because I had phone numbers. I was hooked up, you know. If I didn't understand something, I just had to pick up the phone and call and ask. Man, that was wonderful times, you know. There's so many people that I emanated and grew towards and loved in that program that are no longer around today. But I was talking about it last night. I think it was Bill that said something about in our conversation. They're not really dead and gone. We keep them alive in our memory, and we talk about them, and we repeat the things that we were told that we learned from them. And it's very sad that I can't call them up anymore. They're all at that big meeting in the sky waiting for me. So I'm sure I'll be happy to see them. But and I don't even know what my time is. Okay, I'm good. So I've got my phone here, but my phone never updated to the right time here, so my phone is not correct, but I'm trying to keep that in my mind. I think I'm late for a meeting. I'm not. But I love to go to speaker meetings, and some of you guys that spoke last, all of you that spoke last night, and my Al-Anon lady over there, sweetheart, just love what she had to say, because I came in through that door. That Al-Anon door was open to me. Mm-hmm. I came in to Al-Anon to complain about my alcoholic. And when I found out that they didn't really want to hear me complain about my alcoholic, they wanted me to do some work, then, you know, I thought, well, maybe this Al-Anon thing's not for me. But, you know, after I got sober, I continued to go to Al-Anon. So I have a few more years in Al-Anon than I do in AA, because I'm an alcoholic. And I live with an alcoholic, not a practicing one. Anyway, so, you know, I know I came into the rooms and I looked at the guys, and that kept me there long enough to where I could get the message. And I found a couple of guys, and I'll tell you what Polly P says. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Polly P, but she's been around for a very long time. She's a circuit speaker. And she says, if you're coming to AA to looking for a relationship, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. I found that to be true in some circumstances. And as my picker got better and I got to be a little more emotionally well, I could see that before I said, yes, I'll marry you. Because I don't know about y'all, but relationships in the program, it's like, you know, you go out with somebody, you like them, you probably go to bed with them first right off, and then the next thing you know, there's a U-Haul in front of the house. And then you're in. That's the way most relationships worked out for me. I wasn't really divorced legally from my second husband before I was thinking about getting married to my third one, to my second, my first one and the second one anyway. So I was divorced though, but for probably 11 years before I got married again, before I got sober. And with the three kids, I will tell you, it was not fun raising three children with a practicing alcoholic ex-husband who didn't really give a darn about us and our welfare, and doing that by myself for the first time as an adult. It was a very eye-opening experience, but I had a lot of support from the people in the program, and I got involved with a lot of the women. I got to be close to a lot of the women. That was great for me. I had a lot of women friends that I really trusted and loved, and things began to change, but it was a slow process. They helped me get through some of those children issues. My middle daughter, I didn't think she would live. Honestly, there were times when I thought I was going to get a call from the police and have to go identify the body. And that was very difficult. But if it hadn't been for my friends at Al-Anon and my friends in these rooms and my husband at the time, who's sitting back there, I'll tell you about that in a minute. He used to always tell me, God doesn't have any grandchildren. And I had to look at the way God took care of me through all my drinking experiences and all the times I should have been dead, and I wasn't. You know, I made it to these rooms. And I had to remember that. And I also had to get okay with, well, maybe he thinks that she's too tender to live in this world, that she just can't deal with it, and he wants her to be with him. I had to get okay with that. Couldn't have done that without sobriety. I just could not have, that would have killed me. So that was that middle child. She has 7 years sobriety today. And I'm very proud to say that. I was saving her a seat. And she was not only drugged by the drugs of the day, but she was drugged by me to meetings. Because I drug her to meetings, not because I wanted her to get sober necessarily, but when she was younger, I didn't have anybody to take care of my kids. So I had to bring them to meetings, and I'd sit them in the back with coloring books and their lunch and stuff. And they had fun. They'd go play in the parking lot with some of the other kids that were there at the clubhouse with their parents and go to the dances and have a good time. But I wanted her to be sober so badly. And a lot of the people that were in the program knew her because of that. And she came in and out and in and out for a little while before she got sober. But thank God she's sober today. And her life is just awesome. All my children thanked me. Any of you have children out there that are in the throes of their ism, which alcoholism is a family disease, you know. Everybody gets sick. My mother swore that I wasn't an alcoholic. She said, oh, you caught that from your ex-husband. But, you know, that wasn't true. The gene was there, but nobody knew where it came from. But I found out later, I'll tell you about that too. But about 5 years sober, I just kind of gave up on men. I didn't really want to be with a man. I was loving my life with my girlfriends, my single life. I had everything the way I wanted it. I didn't have to please anybody else at home. And it was pretty awesome. But my kids were going nuts, on the other hand. They were stealing from me. I went home one day and my middle daughter was in my house, which she was not allowed in my house when I wasn't there. And I had locked the door, and her and about five of her skinhead friends were trying to break my door down. And being single, this was quite unnerving for me. But I did the best I could with the support of the people in the rooms. And so, I dated. I did date. After about a year, my sponsor said, okay, you can date if you want to. She said, but let me first of all tell you what a date means, because you don't know how to date. And I said, well, you're probably right, because I haven't been too successful so far. She said a date is when you see someone that you think you might want to go out with, and they want to go out with you, and you have a little bit in common with them, and they call you up or see you in a meeting, say, hey, would you like to have dinner, or would you like to go to a movie, or something like that. You say what you want to say. If you want to say yes, I would love that. They pick you up at a certain time. They take you out. You have a nice evening. They bring you home. You say, thank you so much for the evening. You go inside alone, and they go home. Oh, what a concept. So, I practiced that for a while. That worked out really well. I had a great time. And I was just date. You know, everybody that I wanted to go out with that I couldn't go out with, I accepted. And it was a lot of fun. I learned a lot about myself and about a healthy relationship. And I knew by that time that my picker was broken, so I knew what I wanted and what I didn't want. So I stayed single for 5 years, and I met this guy in the program. He was from New Orleans, because I had grown up in New Orleans through my teenage years, and we were both in Georgia at the time, so naturally it sparked my interest. He was from Louisiana, and he had made a comment in a meeting, and he said how he got arrested on Bourbon Street on New Year's Eve. And I went, whoa, that sounds like my kind of guy. It's difficult to get arrested in New Orleans on Bourbon Street on New Year's Eve. I mean, they let things slide all the time. And so I was very curious. So after the meeting, I cornered him in the hallway, and I said, what did you do? You must have been really bad. And I always liked the bad boys, because I thought I could change them, 6 months for me, and they'll become a good boy. And that never happened. So he told me that he didn't remember because he was in a blackout. And I thought, dang, what a disappointment. But he did remember some things about it, and he told me about it, but that's his story. So that's how I met Red. And we started dating. We became friends. And I had to put my middle child in treatment again. And so I needed a little cash. I was working then, and but I always could use some cash with three kids. And her room was vacant. I had to take the door off of her room before I put her in treatment, because some people talked about the kids don't. You don't want your kids locking your door. You want to know what they're doing. And she would lock her door and hang these black bags all over her window. So I took the door off the hinges. I said, I'll show you. You're not going to do that to me. So took the door off. Had to put the door back on the hinge, but I rented her room out to him. And we were just friends then. But he was wonderful. He helped me a lot, helped me financially with the rent. And we went to meetings together, and the relationship developed more. And we became emotionally, physically involved, and we decided we needed to get married because it was probably the right thing to do. And he was kind of like the disciplinarian, which I never was. You know, my kids always tease me now, Mama, get mad at us, and then the next thing you know, she's laughing at us. So didn't do too good for discipline. And I was having a lot of trouble with kids then, and we were dating for quite a while, and then he asked me to marry him, and I thought about it, and I said, okay. And we got married. We were both very involved in AA. We were involved in service work. We sponsored a lot of people. We did a lot of big book studies together. We did them in a treatment centers and stuff like that. And it was a good match for quite a long time. we worked very well together. We liked each other, and he's very humorous, so he kept me laughing a lot. That helps. Laughter is always good. But, you know, when I was very happy, we were both very happy. Getting used to one another, though, was kind of difficult for someone who had been single for such a long time. At times I thought, oh my God, what'd I do? You know, I had my life, it was so perfect. It was just, you know, me and the girls, and now I've got this extra person that all of a sudden I have to think about. It's like, but, you know, it worked out. And I know relationships in AA are hard because we're both alcoholics, and I continued my Al-Anon meetings then. He didn't like Al-Anon at the time, but you know, it really does make you free of worrying about that alcoholic in your life. You know, you got to let them do what they got to do. And thank God he was working a good program. But my kids, on the other hand, I had to let them all go. I had to tell that middle girl that she couldn't come back and live at home. And I had a hard time doing that. He was a good disciplinarian, though. He helped me out with that. So we were a good team. We were a very good team. And my girls, I felt really bad about telling some of them that they couldn't come home and live. But I knew that if I didn't do that, that I would be enabling them to continue to do what they were doing. And that would not be good for them in the long run. It's very hard to do, to say, I love you, but I'm not coming to get you out of jail. I'm sorry. It's hard to look at your child behind a glass box and talk to him on a phone. It's hard to go into a women's prison and be able to touch your child for the first time in 6 months because I could hug her when she went to prison. That's hard, very hard to do. And still say, I love you. I'll put money on your account, but I'm not getting you out. I'll support you while you're here. And we did that, both of us. I mean, he jumped in with both feet, all of my family. My mother at the time said we had a bad relationship. We were always butting heads. I tried to make amends to her so many times, and we'd end up in a fight. And I'll tell you more about that a little bit later, but the hardest, I got into the program, and when I read the chapter to the alcoholic and when I read the doctor's opinion, that really, really sewed it up for me. Even though I had those things out there that I'd never done, I read that doctor's opinion. It talked about the allergy. It talked about the fact that when I took a drink, my body's different than a normal drinker. When I take a drink, it wants another drink. I'm set up for that. And I didn't understand that for a very long time. But today I look around at people and think, they leave stuff in their glass, you know? It's like, how do people do that? I never left anything on the table. And in fact, if anybody else did, I'd finish it off for them. So, I mean, I would go out for drinks after work. Everybody else went home. I didn't go home. I would just go to the next place where I could get another drink and have some more fun. I literally drank until I couldn't drink anymore or I was passed out, which was usually a lot, and somebody had to take me home. So, that parent that my mother that I didn't like so much, I felt like she was real hypocritical, and they used to talk about people all the time at home, and when they'd go out with, they would be all smiles and happy, and then they'd come home and talk about them. I didn't like that, and I didn't want to hear it anymore. So through my recovery, I was able to love my mother the way she was and tell her that I loved her. And I would go buy these cards for her that would say mushy things for Mother's Day and her birthday, the things that I wish I could say to her, but I didn't because I didn't like her. And over time, working the steps and being in Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to feel that way. And you know what? she changed too. She made a huge change. She got to the point where she would come to parties and stuff, and she would meet my friends from the program, and she'd say, "These are such nice people. I like these people." And she would want to, she said, "I wonder if I could be an alcoholic. Could I be an alcoholic?" It's like, "No, Mom, you're not an alcoholic. In fact, your picture's in the dictionary next to non-alcoholic." My mother, somebody would give her a drink. She'd take a sip of it. She'd say, "Oh, I don't feel great. You know, this is making me feel funny. I don't want any more." And she'd pour it out. It's like, who does that? But then I had a lot of resentments in the beginning because I felt like my biological parents didn't want me. My father's name was not even on my birth certificate, my original birth certificate. My other father was not really in my life much, my adoptive father. My mother, my grandmother was always criticizing me. And I had to forgive all those people and get past that, because that's part of what was making me sick. And I went to a meeting one time and I heard the speaker, and I absolutely love her. She's not speaking much anymore, but I did happen to hear her recently. Somebody got her out of seclusion. I don't know if you've ever heard of Francine Walker. She came up to that podium, and she was actually, she was a streetwalker, which we call that in those days, if y'all know what that means. Now she's got law degrees and can practice law in 5 different states. Very successful woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what she said that really resonated with me was, she said, "We are not born with self-esteem." And she said, "We have to earn that." Made sense. She said, "We have to earn that by doing esteemable things." So ever since then, that was early in sobriety, we learned about helping others, trust God, clean house, and help others. And that's what I did. That gave me the self-esteem I needed, because I didn't have any. Those are just some of the people that helped me out in sobriety. People like Polly P. and Vivian Q., who killed her own daughter driving her drunk around. I mean, I never had to experience that kind of pain, thank God. But if they can do this, if they can get this spiritual thing, the best thing that I heard when I got here was choosing a God of your own conception. It's like, oh, thank goodness, I don't have to have that God, any of those gods that I heard about in church, because I thought I was going to get punished really bad. And my God's a loving God. He's a loving, caring God. He cares about everyone, and every one of us are His children. And I have to think like that. That's hard to do sometimes when you don't like somebody. And I heard all of these other things in sobriety. The steps were real important in my life, and that four-step and fifth-step really opened my eyes to what I'd been like. It told me what my character defects were. It told me that I needed to do something different, which is what the steps are all about. It's a change in thinking. Alcohol was a symptom of my disease. My thinking was my problem, and my thinking was wrong. But through the steps, I learned that I had to change that thinking. And the people around me that I didn't like very much, their thinking kind of changed too. That mama of mine, she got really sick, and I took care of her. Red helped me. She was at home sick for a long time and took care of her, and had to work and do that and everything. And I absolutely loved every minute of it. A caretaker. It's tough when you're working and being a caretaker for someone. She didn't have dementia. She was sharp. But her body just failed. She had congestive heart failure. And finally, I had to put her in a nursing home. I was there every single day. Red was there every single day. My friends in Alcoholics Anonymous were there every single day, listening to her stories and talking to her about their stories. And she died. She died while I was holding her hand. You know, I got to tell her that I loved her very much. I never had to make a verbal amends to her, because I made a living amends to her. I've made a living amends to my children. And I found out later that making them work at a young age, because I didn't have the money to support them fully, they had to get jobs at 15 because they wanted expensive clothes and I couldn't afford that. And they got jobs. You know, they're all responsible human beings today. Even that middle child turned out to be a responsible human being. It's amazing how God has worked in my life if I just let Him. Get out of the way and just let Him. My mom was just, I look back on my childhood and all the bad stuff that I thought was going on, and it's like I had the most charmed childhood that anybody could ever dream of. I had everything I ever wanted. Clothes, I got a car when I was 16 with a credit card. I mean, how many kids get that? Not many. And I'm totally grateful that I had that growing up. Now, I have been rich, I have been poor, I have been almost homeless. There's a lot of things, gone through death of family members, gone through divorces. But you know what? Because of the God of my understanding in this program, I've never had to drink over any of that, which is such a miracle. I'm an alcoholic. What do I think about doing? Drinking. That's what alcoholics do. We drink. What a miracle everyone in this room is sitting in here sober today. That's just a miracle because we drink. And we don't drink anymore because of this program and these steps and the God of my understanding. And I can't tell you how much it means to me. I love the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's like my owner's manual. We don't come with an owner's manual. The kids don't come. They don't pop out with instructions on how to raise them. But the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is my owner's manual. How are we doing back there for time? How are we doing for time back there? We're good? I am just eternally grateful that the people that were in my life in these rooms today turned me on to this book instead of all the other stuff I was turned on to. Because I had a lot of other isms. I got here and I put the drink down. I found out that there were other things that I was addicted to, like men, sex, bad relationships, food, sugar, all those things I had to deal with. But I dealt with them in the same way that I dealt with my alcoholism. There is nothing in this book in life that I can't conquer if I use it on those problems. There's absolutely nothing. Alcoholics Anonymous has made my life wonderful. And Red and I split up, I think you heard that, the other side of that story, but he told it pretty good. We were apart for two and a half years, and we talk about bad behavior, his. I'm 10 years older than he is, by the way. And at 59, is when we split up. He was 49, and we both had about 19 years of sobriety in. And I was looking forward to the retired years. I was looking forward to sitting on the front porch in the rocking chair with Red and, you know, traveling a little bit and just kind of retiring and calming down. And he was like Mr. Real Estate. He had a phone in his ear 24/7, you know, wasn't involved in anything but that. It took him away. It became an addiction, I think. It took him away, and I wasn't real happy with that. And when we moved to Chattanooga, I'm an artist, and Chattanooga gave me a grant money to buy a house there during a period of time when they were wanting artists and teachers to move into the inner city. So we decided to leave LJ, Georgia, which is where we were living then, and moved to Chattanooga. Because we got a really good incentive. They paid us $15,000 in all of our moving expenses. It was really, really, but that was during the market crash. It was just before the bottom fell out of the real estate market. But he was doing really well. I mean, we had lots of money. But that, you know, that doesn't make you happy. It really doesn't. So we get to Chattanooga, and I had a hard time getting hooked up in meetings. I don't know about y'all, but every time we moved to a new place, I kind of need another push because I'm kind of shy. And when I go to new meetings, I'm a little scared, you know. But I do. I make myself go. And he didn't. He didn't go to meetings, and he didn't practice the program. He wanted to hang out in bars and stuff. That was just not what I wanted at 59. But I think he was going through kind of a midlife crisis at 50. I told him he should have just bought a Corvette like most men do. But we chose to separate. He came up and he told me, he said, "I just don't think this is working out. After 15 years of marriage, I don't think this is working out." It's like, hit me like a ton of bricks. I'm thinking, well, crap, you know, what am I going to do? I'm almost 60 years old. I'm 19 years sobriety. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? I'm going to have to get a new career. So I cried a lot, and I decided I was going to leave and go back to LJ because that's where my support, my AA support was. As many times as I've had issues in sobriety that were not really happy issues for me, I did the same thing. I started going back to 90 meetings in 90 days. I was acting like a newcomer. I didn't say anything. I just listened and cried, just like a newcomer. And I got involved in service work, and I got back with my support group so I could deal with that without having a drink. And it was the people in these rooms that supported me and helped me get through that. It was tough. But I went out and I got a new career, called a very good friend of mine who also was from Tracy City, who lived in Jasper, Georgia at the time. His name was Carl. And Carl had about 45 years in sobriety, and he was a counselor. And I called him up and I said, "Carl," because I'm an artist and I was teaching classes and stuff, but it wasn't support. It wasn't enough money to support me, and or not for very long. And so I called him and says, "Is there anything I can do? I've got almost 20 years of sobriety. I've sponsored people. You know, I've taken people through the steps. I've taken them through the book. Is there something I can do to monetarily help myself with that knowledge?" And he was counseling at the time. He said, "Well, I think, I don't know right now, but if I hear of anything, I'll call you." 2 weeks after that, I prayed about it. I prayed about everything. 2 weeks after that, he called me up and he said, "Guess what?" I said, "What?" He said, "There's a CAC class starting. That's an addiction counseling class starting in Jasper. And it's, I think, anybody can come. If you want to come to that and become certified, then you can be a counselor." It's like, well, okay, that sounds like it's right up my alley, you know? So, I went to the class, and before it was even over with, I had a job counseling in an adolescent counseling center. And that started a new career for me. But very frustrating. Very, very, very frustrating career. It lasted about almost 2 years. And I just wanted to cry almost every day for those children who didn't have a choice. Like we talk about praying, the ones who don't have a choice, because their parents were all heavily in addiction. So I did that, and in 2 years, something happened. He got back in the program, and we met up again because I didn't want to have anything to do with him while we were separated and divorced. We met up again, and he started sounding like the guy that I married. And I missed that. I really missed that. And things progressed, and we ended up getting back together. So we've been together ever since. So it's been good. It's been good. 4 years ago, we decided to sell our house in Bay St. Louis in Wayland, Mississippi, and move into a fifth wheel and travel. And the only thing I didn't like about that was the meetings. I loved going to meetings, but some places we went didn't have any meetings. It's hard to believe, but some of these little towns, like in Alabama or Mississippi, there weren't any meetings. And that's the only drawback to that, of course, during COVID, you know. But we got back together again. We travel around. We volunteer at state parks, Corps of Engineer parks, for 3 and 4 months at a time. So we've been here up in LJ for almost a year. it's like home to us. My two of my daughters live in the L&J area, and we like it. You know, it's a good thing we got the program because we live in a tin box. And we have good meetings up here. And I just wanted to say that we're very happy today because of Alcoholics Anonymous in this book. We're back in our meetings. We know people up here. And what I wanted to do was to close with something that means a lot to me in this book. This is my little book. And I got to really wear glasses to do this. And I want to close with, also, I want to thank the committee so much for bringing us all here. And all the speakers that were here this weekend were awesome. Thank you for renewing my spirit. That's why I always get my spirit renewed when I get in here and hear the speakers. So I'd like to tell you, especially for this newcomers, it says, because I love this big book, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize that only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. These answers will come if our own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless and keep you all. Until then, get into the book. Thank you so much for being here.